Okay, so welcome for our computer graphics lecture. Sorry for the delay, but now we have a completely fresh computer. At least we are with this respect on the safe side. So last Thursday I spoke about clipping, and clipping is a problem, or the problem that is handled by clipping is that we typically have a rectangular viewport, a rectangular window, which we draw our objects into. And now it, of course, regularly happens that these objects are partially outside this window and now have to be clipped. That means everything outside the window needs to be cut off before it is rendered. And so we saw an algorithm for clipping of lines. As I said, of course, the part that is more interesting for us is not how to clip lines, but to clip polygons. And now you might say, okay, a polygon is just a set of edges, so if I know how to clip lines, I know how to clip polygons. But in fact, that's not the case. So if we look at this example here, we have this triangle, P1, P2, P3, and P1 is outside of our window, and now the point is that it is not enough to clip these lines, but instead we are not interested in the edges only, but also in the interior. And to describe the interior correctly, after this clipping, we need to generate this object, and this object now has four vertices. And now we get a quadrilateral, and this is the clipped version of that triangle. Yeah? And we are not only interested in this edge and this edge and this edge, but in fact, this new edge here also has to be generated to get a closed loop again. Now, for that example, you might say, okay, that's still very, very simple, but there can also more difficult cases happen. Yeah, so look at this example here. Now, here it really becomes more complicated, and this quadrilateral here becomes something with eight vertices, I think. And in this example, now something even more difficult happens, because if we only clip the lines, what remains is only this part here. And now we have to add these two edges so that we get back a closed polygon again. Yeah, so obviously it's a bit more. And yeah, we will see examples. So this is a particular difficult example. We have to see how we can expand or extend our clipping algorithm to do the clipping also for polygons. And of course, the line clipping will be an important part, because this edge here is the clipped version of this edge, but these other edges here along the clipping boundary, these we also have to take care about. Okay, this algorithm is also pretty old. The idea is quite simple. I mean, you just need to understand the problem and see the solution, and then it is rather clear that it's the way how it should work. The idea is the following. So first of all, we only look at the window edges one after the other. We don't clip immediately against all four or however many we have, but we do it edge by edge. Yeah, and we clip every single polygon, or we clip our polygon first against one edge. This gives us a new polygon, and then we clip it against the next edge. We will see examples why this is the first important part. And then we make we look at that problem, which is now already a bit easier. So we only have one single edge. Yeah, on the left, this should be out. Here on the right, it's in. Yeah. And what we can do now is that we just walk along this polygon, and we will realize whatever happens here on the left is of no interest. Yeah? Whenever there are edges here on the left, we don't care about them. They are outside. Yeah? We walk from P1 to P2, that's outside. Doesn't matter. From P2 to P3, an interesting thing now happens. Now we enter our clipping area. That means, okay, from now on, we have to be careful. or from now on we have to generate, or we are entering the interesting part. And in that case, that means if we come from outside to inside, what we first, obviously, yeah, at that point we cross our clipping edge. So what we have to do is that we compute this intersection. We know from line clipping how to do that. So we compute S1, and then we say, okay, now we start a new polygon, and it starts at that point, and P3, which is inside, is already the second point of our new polygon. Yeah? So we output two points, S1 and P3. And from now on, we are inside. And now all the edges which are inside are also edges of the clipped polygon. So P3, P4 belongs to our solution. Yeah. So this will be the final solution, by the way. Yeah. So now we have this edge. This is completely inside. And now the last case, possible case happens. We have an edge that goes from outside, no, from inside to outside. And in that case, again, we output this point and we compute the intersection and output this intersection here. So what we get now as a result is S1, P3, P4, S2, and in fact this forms our new clip polygon. Yeah? And since this edge is straight, it also directly generates a loop. Yeah? So S2 and S1, if we directly connect these and close the loop, we get a closed polygon again. Okay. So the idea, we have a stream of input vertices, yeah, and now we process the stream P1, P2, P3, P4, and depending on, and we always keep remember whether we are outside and inside, and depending on whether we go from outside to inside, from inside to inside, from inside to outside, or from outside to outside, we output new vertices. Yeah? And this gives an output stream of vertices. And this output stream is the clipped polygon. Yeah? And for the different cases, that's quite simple now. So we have the following four cases, as I already said. So let's assume we have two successive vertices, both inside. Then we simply output these vertices. So if the last vertex was Pi, the new vertex is Pi plus 1. We go from inside to inside, so that means we emit Pi plus 1 to the output stream. If we go from inside to outside, we compute the intersection and output or emit the intersection. If we go from outside to inside, we compute the intersection and we emit the intersection and the new point. And if we go from outside to outside, we do nothing. Yeah? So that's very simple rules that can be applied on this stream of vertices, and it generates an output stream with a clip polygon. Yeah? So that's really simple. Very simple to implement. Here again, for this example, input stream goes from P1 to P4, and here we have to close the loop. Yeah. So that means the input stream must contain here the P1 again. So the edges that we process are P1, P2, P2, P3, P3, P4, P4, P1. And yeah, now all of these belong to one of these four cases that we had before. And this is the resulting output. Yes. Yeah. So this one should belong to that arrow. And if we look at that output, yeah, we see that it's again a closed loop, and this one is also screwed up. Sorry, formatting got lost here. Yeah, but I think the principle is very simple. Now, as I said, this is only for one particular edge, and now our clipping area typically or ideally is a convex polyhedra. So in that case, for instance, this triangle here, it doesn't have to be rectangular, it can be something convex. And now we do what we can do is that we do the clipping successively versus or against all these edges. Yeah? And we first clip, for instance, against this edge, and then against this, and then against this one. Yeah? So if we start with the setup, we first clip against this edge. This gives us this result. And then we clip against this edge, and this gives us this result. And then we are done. I mean, again, we have to clip against this one, but here nothing happens. And now this is really important to do it this way, because otherwise we can easily construct cases where it will fail. So let's say this is our clipping area. Now we have this triangle. Yeah, and now it's a bit tempting to say, okay, we have this in-out classification and so on. So we start with this. We look at this here, P1, P2, P3. Now this edge is from outside to outside. Nothing needs to be done. Yeah? Now we go from outside to inside. Okay, maybe P3, let's make like this. Yeah? Now we go from outside to inside, that means emit this point and emit P3. Yeah? So our output is SP3 or S1, because now we go from here to here, from inside to outside, that means compute point S2, and emit this one, and now we are outside, 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 nothing happens. Yeah? So we get this solution. And this solution would be this triangle. And this is definitely the wrong solution. Yeah? It's somewhat, at least it's not completely wrong, but there's an important part missing. Yeah? And this is just because I did not differentiate and say, OK, I first clip against this one. This would have delivered this polygon. And then clip against this one. And at that step, we would get the right solution. Yeah? OK, good. So it's a little thing to take care of, but it makes a difference. And now one nice thing with this algorithm is that this is really a pipeline. Yeah? So what we can see this or interpret this is that we have a stream of vertices coming in, and now we have four stages, and each of these stages takes the stream of vertices, clips against one of the clip edges, and outputs a new stream of vertices of the clip triangle. Yeah? And this stream is then handled by the next stage. Yeah? This does the clipping against the right, and outputs this one, and so forth. Yeah? And this is something which is very nice to parallelize. So all these four stages can work in parallel, and the last stage can output the first vertices while there are still new vertices coming in on the left. Yeah? So that's a neat property of that method. Okay, I mean, it's probably not implemented like that on a real graphics board, because there we always have triangles and so on, so I'm sure there's a more advanced and performant solution, but it's I think a nice picture. Okay, yeah, so number one that we have to extend our simple line clipping is that, in fact, we normally do not look at lines but at polygons, and in that case we have to take more care to really get a polygon version or a clipped polygon. That's quite easy to understand, I think, but in fact there's another issue that we have to take care of which is much more difficult to understand. And in fact I can So when I learned computer graphics here at the very same universities about 20 years ago, a really long time, we also had programming exercises. And in these programming exercises, they were mean enough to let us implement the line clipping on our own. And everybody realized that fails and we have a problem, and nobody found out where this came from. And the reason I would like to try to explain now here with these slides. And this is really a weird and subtle thing, but I find it very interesting. So this setup here, what you see here, is a schematic view of perspective projection. Yeah? So the green thing here is the view frustum. This here, this is the position of our camera, and this is the near, and this is the far plane. Yeah? I took a very far near plane in order to better be able to color these different regions that we have. Yeah? So this is the view frustum seen from the side. So this is our view direction. So this is the view frustum. And our perspective mapping maps this one to the unit cube. Yeah? You remember that one, that we had this for perspective mappings. OK, and now let's look at this case. This is a line. It has here its starting point and here the end point, or the other way around. Yeah? Here starting point, here the end point. So the important thing is that it crosses here this plane. That means it is a line. So if I look into this direction, it would be a line that where I see the end point, and then it goes behind me and it ends behind me. Yeah? That would be such a case of a line. So it's nothing special. It's something that happens very, very often. Okay, yeah, this line, it ends behind me, or one end point is behind me and one is in front of me and I see it. Okay, and now I want to do clipping. Yeah, that means essentially, since this is my view frustum, yeah, I would like to, clipping should keep this part here, this part of the line, and the rest should be thrown away. Yeah? That's what I hope. So my plan, I take this point, project it, do this entire perspective projection. I take this point, do the projection, look at the line, the resulting line, yeah, and clip this one against my canonical view, view volume. And this will fail. And why will it fail? OK, now we have to look a bit closer at this situation. That's again the situation we just had. And now if we map, I said, the perspective projection maps this one to the unit cube. Yeah? OK, it's not a unit cube, it's a unit rectangle. OK, yeah, it maps this one to this cube here, to this rectangle. So that's fine. But now something very weird happens. If we look, observation number one, as I said, projective mappings map lines to lines. So obviously the line that is defined by these two points, yeah, needs to be mapped to a line again. Let's say it looks like this. Yeah? And obviously, if this line intersects these two points, yeah, it also has to intersect these two points after the mapping. Yeah? So we can just take this point, do the projection, then we end here. And this point, do the projection, and we end here. And all these points on this line are mapped to points on this line. Yeah? But the weird thing now is, if we look at the points between from here to here, we find out that these points are not mapped to this part of the line. Yeah? That would be just the points connecting these points. Yeah? They are not mapped. This solid line is not mapped to this part, but instead it's mapped to the other rest of that line. That means to this half line and to this half line. Yeah, that's a bit weird. So this line is mapped to this line, but this line segment is mapped to two of these half lines. And yeah, how can this happen? The reason is quite simple, as I already said. Perspective mappings can map points at finite points to points at infinity and vice versa. So what happens here is that this point where the set equals zero plane is intersected, this point here is mapped to infinity. So in fact, if we go along, or if we go from here to here, yeah, we first go through, we do not progress in this direction, but instead we go in this direction, yeah, here. And when we are here, we are at infinity, and then, don't care, I turn it off. And then we come back from infinity and end up here. Yeah? So since this point is mapped to infinity, yeah, this line segment here is mapped to these two half rays. Okay, that's weird, but that's how it is. And now this has consequences, because what we are not allowed, or what, I mean, we are allowed to, but it will deliver wrong results. What we should not do now is that we take the two points, project them, do the perspective projection, and then take the connecting line and clip that one, because then only this small part here will remain. That means what will remain is that part here, yeah, that didn't belong to the original line at all. Yeah? So we should not clip or not further use this line segment, but instead these two half rays. Yeah? And in fact, this is this part is behind the camera, so that part is not important. So in fact, we only have to further consider that half line here. Yeah? And that's something, yeah, really a bit surprising at a first glance. Yeah? So transform these two points, yeah, and then generate this half line. And this is the one which we have to further work with. And in particular, also do the clipping. Yeah? We have to clip that line, and then the right part remains. OK, so that sounds complicated, but there's a quite nice solution to do that, because we do all these perspective mappings in homogeneous coordinates. And in fact, it turns out that we can solve all these clipping issues and all these problems by simply doing the clipping in homogeneous coordinates before we dehomogenize. And to explain this, let's look at this very simple example. This again explains the problem. Yeah? So let's say, again, this is our camera. Yeah, this is the point where we the eye point. We are looking into this direction. So this is set, and in fact, if you look at this projection matrix, you see that the projection matrix maps set to W. Yeah. So in homogeneous coordinates, this distance here is your W value. Okay. Good. And now you have to imagine this is the x-axis, but this could also be, could also be y, yeah, the image plane. Good. So dehomogenization means divide by W, and in fact, it means this dehomogenization. Yeah, if we look at that point here, for instance, yeah, that has a particular x and w coordinate. And to compute the image coordinates, we divide x by w, and this means just project this point onto this plane w equals 1. Yeah, that's this perspective projection. So dehomogenization means this point is mapped to this point, and this is our image plane. Our image plane is the plane where W equals 1. Yeah? And this point here, which now has the problem that it's behind the camera, this point will be projected to here. And now we see, again, this problem. Yeah, the projection of this line, yeah, if we do this projection to this line, this point ends here, but this point, for instance, ends here, and this point here, and this point here, and this point here, and this point here. So this line segment is mapped to that half line, yeah, to that ray going to infinity. And this point here is mapped to something very far down here, and this point is mapped to here, and this point to here, and this point to here. So in fact, this line segment is not mapped to this one, but instead to this and this half line. Yeah? It's kind of try to visualize that with this dehomogenization. Yeah, what dehomogenization does. Okay, so how can we use that now? As I said, the right solution is to do the clipping in homogeneous coordinates. What does that mean? Again, the same situation. Yeah, we have this line in homogeneous coordinates. Yeah, and now we look at our clipping volume, and in fact, our clipping volume, we will see that the clipping volume now is not a rectangle, but instead it is again such a pyramid here that can easily be derived. We will show that on the next slide. Yeah. So it is all the points within this triangle. That's our clipping volume. Yeah. That's the set of points where x over w is less than 1, for instance, that results in this diagonal here. Okay, so now we have a more weird clipping volume, but if we manage to do the clipping against this volume, we do the right thing. Now we have that line. That's the line we want to clip. Now we do the clipping against this clipping volume, so this little part remains. And if we project this onto the image plane, then this part remains. That's exactly the part that we wanted. Yeah, and not like here. Okay, it's too much offset that we can see the difference. Yeah, directly mapping these points would result, this point is mapped to here, this one is mapped to here, and then we would get this part of the line. Yeah, but in fact, we want to keep this part. Okay. Yeah, that's a bit, maybe you have to look at these slides a few more times. I think it is understandable at some point. Okay, so now our point is, yeah, how can we do the clipping now against this weird volume? And in fact, it turns out that we essentially can just reuse the ideas of alpha clipping. There's one little tiny thing that we have to change. So we use alpha clipping. Now we have to clip against, our clipping volume will change, yeah. In homogeneous coordinates, the canonical volume which we want to clip looks different. That's what we saw before, and this can easily be derived. Yeah. So if we say a homogeneous point x, y, z, w is in the canonical volume simply if it is in the canonical volume after dehomogenization. That means the right boundary check just means dehomogenize the point x over w, and if this is less than 1, we are inside the right boundary of our canonical view volume. Yeah? And now this one we can simply replace. Yeah, we just multiply by w, then we get x smaller than w. And the same is true for, almost the same for left, top, and bottom. We can derive very similar formulas. Yeah, and x is smaller than w is exactly this line. Okay, it should be, yeah, exactly, yeah. X smaller than w clips directly against this line. And this is the criterion for left. Yeah, and we can do the same for y. And what we get then are these boundaries. Yeah? Left becomes x larger than minus w, right x smaller than w, and so forth. So if you compare it with a canonical view volume, the only difference is that instead of minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, and 1, 1, 1, here we have minus w, and here we have w. That's for now the only difference. Yeah. So that makes things, so obviously things are not that complicated as they look. And now we can even go further. Now we do alpha clipping. Yeah. So now let's assume, we have a line from here to here, some line, and now we want to compute the intersection with this clipping plane here. Yeah. We have a line from here to here, and we want to compute this intersection. yeah, how can we do that? Well, we have a homogeneous point P and a homogeneous point Q. We say the line of all points are these, and alpha is this parameter, parameterizing the line. Now, this line will intersect the right boundary. The right boundary is x equals w. If, we just, here we plug in, or we take the x component of this here, of this point, that's this, and this must equal the y w component, that's this. Yeah. So that's just simply plugging in. And now if we solve for alpha, we get this formula here. And yeah, if we compare this with a formula that we had for alpha clipping, we will see that it's very similar. And in alpha clipping, we optimize that using window edge coordinates. Yeah? And the only difference with the alpha clipping that we had before is this PW is x max. This one is x max, and this is q. This one also is x max. Yeah. So, what we can quickly see is that we just to apply that algorithm again. Yeah, we can use the original algorithm, but we just take a slightly different way to compute our window edge coordinates. Yeah. So we now have window edge coordinates which take 4 points as input. I mean 4 coordinates, yeah? That's a window edge coordinate on the point with homogeneous coordinates. And it's not x max minus x, but it's w minus x. That's the entire difference. Yeah? Oops. And with these window edge coordinates, we can derive the same alphas as before, or with the same formula, we get the alphas at the intersection points, and by computing the intersection points with all our clipping planes, we exactly get that part of the line that is within this volume. Yeah? And this part now doesn't have that problem. It contains no part behind the camera, because that has been clipped away. So we are all in front of the camera, and now we can do the simple projection by projecting the starting point and the ending point, and we get the right part. Yeah? So a very little extension or change in our clipping, but as a result, it makes the algorithm work right. Okay, good. So, I mean, I can understand that this part is, you have to maybe think about that. So look at the slides again. Of course, you're also open to ask me. But I really find that a very neat property, because it's a very interesting property of these perspective or projective mappings. And there are other cases where such things become important and interesting, but this is a very, very prominent one. Okay, good. So this ends our chapter on clipping. Yeah. So I showed you how to clip simple lines. That's quite simple. And then today I showed you how this can be extended for polygons. And mean subtlety with respect to perspective mappings. Yeah, that with perspective mappings, or I mean, essentially the message is that the clipping should be done before the dehomogenization. So if you have your rendering pipeline, we have all the coordinates coming in. So one of the first steps is that we make these coordinates homogeneous coordinates. We add a 1 at the last entry. Then we push all these values through our matrices, the different ones. And then after the projection, we have, again, 4-dimensional coordinates. And at that stage, we have to do the clipping. And if the clipping is done, we can do the dehomogenization. Yeah? And if we do that before, then we run into these problems. OK, good. So much on this part. Are there any questions on that part? None. Okay, so then let me make a short announcement. So next Tuesday, I will have to travel again, and I would like to kind of compensate that by adding an extra 45 minutes next Thursday, so Thursday next week and the week after. Is that an, I mean, we have the flexibility since we have that 1 hour slot, yeah? So my proposal would be, so next Tuesday, I think it's the third, no lecture. And then instead on Thursday 5th, we take the full slot and on the 12th. Is that okay? Good? Okay. So we will also send it on the mailing list, but if you know colleagues that are not here today, please tell them. And also the one filming the lecture, that you would possibly communicate that to the others. Okay, so no lecture next Tuesday. That's the important message. Okay. Good, so now this brings us to the last step of the rendering pipeline. Yeah? So we have now all these processes. Yeah, we know how to represent our geometric models using vertices and indexed face sets and stuff like that. We know how to do lighting computations on these objects, how to compute color. We know how to transform these objects into screen space. We know how to rasterize these objects in screen space and to shade them, to compute colors for the interpolated pixels, and to, how to do the clipping. But there's one thing that is still needs to be resolved, and that's occlusion. Yeah? Occlusion simply means, so as we described it up to now, if we render two triangles, then it will always happen that the later rendered triangle will overdraw the previous one. So if we look at that example, everybody will say, okay, this triangle is in front of this one. Yeah? But in fact, this just comes from the order in which we paint them. And it could easily be that, in fact, the situation is like this, yeah? That this triangle is behind this one. We just decided to take the wrong order during rendering. And of course, that part, to do that correctly, is very, very important. Yeah? And we have to find a solution for that. And I mean, in fact, the solution that is used in computer graphics is very obvious. That's the set buffer. But we will see that the set buffer has, is very, very simple. Typically, you don't have to care about that at all. But there are important cases where you have to take care of that. So, how can we do that? How can we solve that? The first way, the first method that could come into mind is to use the so-called Painter's algorithm. So Painter is not a person, or it's not a name. It's just one who paints, yeah, who paints paintings. And what they, of course, do is that they draw an image from back to front. So they first draw the background. And then on top of this, they draw persons or whatever, yeah, so that objects appear in the right order. And of course, this could also be applied in graphics. So what we could do is that we simply take all the objects in our scene, sort them back to front, and render them in the right order. This is perfectly right, perfectly okay. But of course, there is the problem that this sorting here needs to be done for every frame. Because whenever your camera changes, the order can change. Yeah? An object that is first in front of another one, if I change my view direction and look from the other side, then the order changes. Yeah? I'd have to resort or do the sorting again for every frame. And if we have a scene with, let's say, 10 million triangles, that means we have to sort 10 million triangles every frame. And even with a very fast sorting algorithm, that will take some time. So that's not really a very good solution. And in fact, it cannot solve everything. Yeah? So there are nice situations. I mean, that one is a bit artificial, yeah? But you can try to sort that. It won't work, because sorting always assumes that you have a real order on the objects. And here you cannot define one, yeah? Because it's cyclic. And here another case, this is penetrating triangles or objects. Yeah? Here, obviously, this part of the triangle is in front of the quadrilateral, and here it's the other way around. Yeah? So with a Painter algorithm, you just won't find a solution for these two cases. Of course, now one might say, OK, they are just disallowed, and then we are fine. But of course, there's a much nicer and cleaner way that you essentially don't have to take care about occlusion, typically, and that's the so-called set buffer. And the set idea of the set buffer is very simple. For every pixel in the image, we keep an additional depth value. Yeah? And this depth value just stores how far is this fragment, how far is the color that is stored currently in this pixel, how far is this corresponding point currently away from the camera. And now if we render a new triangle, yeah, for every pixel that we set, we compute its depth and compare it with a value in the set buffer. And if we are closer, then we override the pixel. And if we are further away, all the computation we did up to then was for nothing. And we simply do not write the pixel because this information here is hidden. It's hidden by a previously drawn object. Yeah, so one result is, I mean, and that's obvious, if objects overlap, only the frontmost sets the color of the pixel. So all the computations for the objects behind were wasted. Yeah, so that's not optimal. But on the other hand, the nice thing is with the set buffer, it's almost for free. Yeah? And it does the complete occlusion computation for us. There are only two things that we additionally need. First is the memory for the depth buffer. So in former times, that was a very big issue. But now it is less in terms of memory. The second thing is that during rasterization, we also need the depth values. We need depth values. That means when we rasterize a triangle, like this, A, B, C, per vertex, we do not only need x and y coordinates, as we had up to now. We were only looking at x and y coordinates. But instead, we also need z coordinates for all these points. So that's the depth of this point with respect to the current camera that will change per triangle. Yeah, these are not world space coordinates. These are, yeah. In fact, it will be coordinates after the perspective transformation. Yeah, so they change whenever the camera moves. They are not constant. And now during rasterization, we have to interpolate these values. Yeah? So if we are here at some pixel, we need the set value of this pixel. We need to interpolate that. And I mean, we know how to interpolate during rasterization. We did that for Gouraud shading and for Phong shading and so on. So that's simple. And now we also have to do that for set. Yeah? That's easy. OK, good. So that's the kind of second prize. And now there's an interesting thing, because as I already said, these coordinates here, x, y, and z, they are in clip space, so after the perspective transformation happened. And now you might say, okay, these z values are not really the distance to the camera. You remember last, or in one of the slides of the perspective transformation, I told you that the mapping of z world to z, yeah, clip or whatever we called that one, yeah? So if there's the perspective mapping, so this mapping is not linear. There's this weird curve happening, yeah, that maps these values like this, roughly. So it's something with 1 over z, roughly like this. Yeah. So it's a nonlinear mapping. So is it really correct to interpolate these values now directly? Yeah? These are these values after this weird mapping. And in fact, it is right. The good thing is that the projective mapping maps, as I already said several times, maps lines to lines. And that also means that it maps planes to planes. That is, every triangle, or every triangle that undergoes this mapping here, is again mapped to a planar triangle. Yeah, and this is only the case because these set values also undergo this weird mapping. Yeah, so in fact, this one helps us only with that. A triangle is also still a triangle after this mapping. Yeah? So if we push all these vertices through our matrices, in the end, again, we have the vertices of a triangle, and it doesn't get curved or bent or whatever. Yeah? And only because of that, we can do an interpolation here of the set values again. OK, good. But that was just a little side remark. Good. So that means, during rasterization, we interpolate the depth values. And now, additionally, we have the set buffer. It is a buffer that has the same size as the image that we want to render. And it stores for every pixel. Yeah, in contrast to the frame buffer, it doesn't store a color per pixel, but a depth value. Yeah? And if we want to set a pixel, we do not only have to provide the position of the pixel and the color we want to set, but also the depth. Yeah, and now the depth is compared with the depth that is currently stored in the depth buffer. And if we are behind, then simply nothing happens. Yeah? It is the color is not written. Otherwise, the color is written, and the depth in the depth buffer or in the set buffer is set to the new depth. Yeah? So set is always decreasing. It's always only getting closer to the viewer during rendering. OK, so that's very simple. Yeah, so that would be how the set pixel method that we, I think, used in some of the pseudocode would look now. And the difference is now we also have a depth. And it simply compares the set buffer value with depth. And only if the depth is smaller than the current value, then we override the color. And we also update the depth. And otherwise, simply nothing happens. Yeah. So it's per pixel that we do this occlusion test in a very, very simple manner. OK. Now that's very simple. It, in contrast to the painter's algorithm, it can also handle more difficult cases, and that's penetration and cyclic occlusion. Yeah. These two cases here, it can handle this one, this case. Yeah. Because it's just these fragments will be further or closer, and here these fragments will be closer from the quadrilateral, and here the other ones, and you get a clear boundary here where this changes, and also this is possible. That's also no problem. So all these difficult cases can also be handled. We need. Of course, the depth buffer also needs to be initialized, and it's typically initialized with a far value. We have a far plane, yeah, so we can initialize it with a depth of the far plane. The interpolation of depth, luckily, is quite simple because we have these properties that I just described. Yeah? And typically you don't have to take care about that, or you don't have to worry about that, and you didn't have to do that up to now in the programming exercises, because the hardware simply does that for you. Yeah, you don't even notice it, that it's happening. I think you have to enable it at some point. Yeah, you have to say GL enable GL depth test, and then for all the pixels, this test is automatically done. Yeah. So yeah, that's the ideal thing that can happen. Okay. So a few things, however, are interesting, and at a few places, it might happen that you realize that there's something going on for you, and you have to take care a little bit. So one of the first things is that the depth that is stored in the set buffer is the depth or the set value after normalization. So it's in this range, -1 to 1. It's not in the range from near to far, but it's in the range after normalization from -1 to 1. And that means it underwent this strange mapping here. And in fact, yeah, so that's this mapping. So near is mapped to -1, far is mapped to 1, and you see it's not linear in between. And what you can also see, this curve here is very steep in the beginning and almost flat in the end. And this has a not so nice consequence, because in fact, so if we say near to far, it behaves like this, that if near is mapped to -1, the 2, the 0 is already reached for 2n. And for far, we are here at 1. And it is very, very flat here. So that means if you set your near plane to, let's say, 1 centimeter, a set or the range from 1 centimeter to 2 centimeters is mapped to the depth range of -1 to 0. So the entire first half of our depth interval is wasted for the first centimeter in front of the camera. Yeah, that's a complete waste. Yeah, because if your scene only starts at 1 meter, you have the absolute largest range. Yeah, so for instance, here your scene, let's say this is the range where your scene really lives. And the depth values that you get are only in that little range. And this entire range here is wasted. Yeah? You can typically see that if you look in the values in a set buffer. Typically, all the depth comparisons happen in a range of something like between 0.99 to 1. Yeah? So this is far. Yeah, and this is the range where the objects live. Yeah, and the depth values are really in that little range, and all the precision that we would have here in this close range is wasted. In order to so that this works, you need a good precision for these depth values here. Yeah, that has quickly been observed. And in fact, that was one of the main problems, that you need typically at least 24 or better 32 bits depth precision. Yeah? For color, you have 8 bits, but for depth, you need at least 24 bits. Otherwise, this what happens here is that objects that are very close together or that are not too far away from each other, let's say this is object A, this is object B, and in depth, they are not distinguishable anymore. Yeah, they are mapped to the same set value. And then it's just occlusion cannot be resolved, and the one that is drawn first survives. Yeah? And this is wrong in 50% of the cases. Okay, so that means, essentially, what you have, you really should take care, if the near plane is to be chosen, not to be wasteful and say, okay, I want to see everything up to 1 centimeter in front of my lens. I mean, that's valid. But in terms of precision, this can result in a problem. Yeah? So try to move the near plane to a reasonable distance, yeah, something like 1 meter or so, yeah, because it gains you a lot of precision here for the depth value where you need it. Yeah? And you can let break down your application simply by choosing a very small n, then at some point suddenly your depth comparisons don't work anymore and you get weird results. Okay, good. Near plane should be chosen well. Good, so this brings us to a few tricks that you can do if you understand how the set buffer works. So one thing that is very obvious or very clear is that it would be nice to be able to generate such hidden line drawings. Yeah? So that's a line drawing, but in fact all hidden lines are hidden. They are not shown. Yeah? In contrast to this is wireframe. This really looks like only the edges are modeled as a wire and you can just look through the faces. And here you also see which faces are there and they generate occlusion. Yeah? Now, just rendering the lines and turning on the set buffer won't help. Yeah? Because this line here is just rendered. It's not occluded by anything in front. Yeah? There's no line occluding that. But it's this face here that is occluding this line. Yeah, and of course, that's very simple how you can solve that. You somehow have to first fill the set buffer using the polygonal model and then draw the lines in a kind of second pass. Yeah? So first, the idea, first render this scene with filled polygons. Yeah, first render that one to fill the depth buffer. So every pixel now contains the distance to the frontmost face. Yeah? And this rendering is typically only done to the depth buffer. So the frame buffer is left unchanged. This can be turned on. Yeah? The frame buffer can be locked. You can say, okay, now I want to render, but the frame buffer should not be changed. Yeah? So on the screen, nothing happens. Yeah? But the depth buffer is set. But you don't see the depth buffer. Yeah? But the depth buffer values are set accordingly. And then in a second pass, the outlines are rendered. And now this line, for instance, here will be hidden because this surface here in front filled the set buffer so that all these parts here will be hidden. Yeah? So that's very simple. But you will find out a new problem, and that's the following. So if we render this line here, and we rendered the entire object before, then the set values of this line ideally will be exactly the same as those in the from the first rendering pass. Yeah? So when we rendered this entire cube here, yeah, we get set values here for the pixels along that line, and when we render these pixels again, we render directly at the same depth. Yeah? And, okay, now, directly rendering at the same depth means that in our depth comparison, we will compare set, yeah, with set. Yeah? In the frame buffer, there should be exactly the same depth value. Okay, now we are typically rendering with float precision. That means we can never rely on that two values that should be the same really are the same. There can always be a bit in the end going up or down and at different phases in the algorithm. And So what will happen is that quite regularly, although we are directly on the surface, yes, the set test will say, I think he's just a little bit behind, and will throw away these pixels. And as a result, this line here will not be continuous, but it will be dotted, and there will be pixels disappearing. And this can be shown here, or is shown here. So this is our well-known teapot. This is a hidden line rendering that we want to have, and if we don't take care of this effect that I just said, we will get this result. And here you see all these little holes in the lines, and they just happen because, at that point the line, due to numerical imprecision, is assumed to be just a little bit behind the surface. Yeah? Okay, and of course the solution is quite simple, and it is just when we render the lines, these lines here, we just have to pull them a little bit towards the camera, just to move them a little bit in front so that this numerical precision issues are no longer an issue. And now this sounds very hacky, and in fact it is hacky. But there are ways to make it a little bit less hacky. One core idea here is the following. If we assume that we have a surface like this, and now we have this point, this is a line that lies on the surface. Okay, it's not visible from that camera, let's say here. It's a line that we see here. And now the problem is that since we are looking at this almost orthogonally, moving that line a little bit in this direction, or a point here, we have to move more into this direction than if the point is here. And in particular, close to the silhouettes, here, we really, really have to move it far towards the camera to get off the surface. Just because moving towards the camera here means moving it along the surface. And whereas here, we are pretty safe. Just moving a little bit towards the camera directly moves off the surface. So obviously this offset should be different for that part than for that part. And it obviously somehow depends on this angle here between the normal and the view direction. And because this problem is so common and these hidden line renderings are quite often done, there's a typical extension in most of these APIs, and this is typically called polygon offset, and this takes care of that. It really computes an offset that depends also on the normal direction. And I don't need to go into details here. You can look at the web pages in OpenGL. There's directly a command gl polygon offset, and it explains how this is controlled, and you can, with parameters, you can set how big this offset should be and so on. And with this, it is really possible to cleanly solve that issue so that also in difficult situations no artifacts appear anymore. I mean, you can always bring these methods to a limit, and generate surfaces that have very weird structure so that this will break, but in practical cases, this is not an issue. Okay, good. So that's set buffer fighting. It's a very nice word. Because set the same, or two objects are rendered, they both have the same set value, and then it's kind of random which one will win the depth test. And you don't want your depth test to be random, you want it to be deterministic and predictable. So this fighting should be avoided. And it appears in many different instances. It's always a similar problem. Okay, another nice trick is so-called haloing. So that's a technique for rendering line drawings, and in order to better perceive depth in such line drawings, what can often be done is that a line, or if two lines intersect, then the one behind is broken here. There's a gap, and this immediately makes clear to a viewer which line is in front and which is behind. Yeah, so it's a very common technique. And yeah, in fact, this one can be very easily achieved. It's just to show you such a nice trick. Again, by rendering in two passes. And in the first pass, we render all these lines, again, only to the depth buffer, but we render it with a larger line width. Yeah, that's a parameter that can be turned on. So you can say render all the following lines should be rendered with a width of 6 pixels. Yeah, and then lines are rendered thicker. But we only render them to the depth buffer. Yeah, and if we then in the second pass again render all these lines, but now with normal thickness, thickness 1 or a smaller thickness, then the remaining values in the set buffer result exactly in this halo. Yeah? So because in the depth buffer, this thicker line has been rendered, and this occludes now this back line, and this looks like exactly this gap that we want to have here. Yeah? It's a very, very nice trick, not complicated. You can try that in 5 minutes, and it works very well. Okay, good. Now these are little tricks with a set buffer. But now we come to problems. Yeah? As I said, the set buffer does not solve all problems. And the major problem that happens together or in combination with a set buffer is transparency. So from time to time, you might say, OK, it would be interesting now to also render an object which is transparent. That means you can see, you can look through the object and see objects in the background, yeah, like a colored glass or a window, which is a painted window or whatever, yeah, sunglasses, stuff like that. Okay, now that's a difficult problem, and in the rest of the lecture, I would like to try and explain why this is difficult, but it can be solved. So, first of all, yeah. So this is an example what we would like to achieve, and maybe you can see it a little bit better like that. Yeah, we have a reddish or a red object, and that's a bit. It's semi-transparent. It has red color, but you can also see the background through. Yeah. And yeah, how can we generate such effects? An important way or important method in computer graphics used in many, many places is what we call alpha blending. And the idea is the following. Whenever we render a pixel, or let's say we did all the rasterization and now we have a particular pixel color and we want to set a pixel with a certain color. And now instead of just writing this color into the pixel, we blend the new color with the color that was in the buffer before. Yeah? So if we first render that blue object, and in the second pass we render the red object, since the red object or the blue object, the background is still visible through the red object, we want to blend the new red color with a background that has already been written before. Yeah? So we blend the red and the blue color in the background. And we do that by simply saying, OK, the new value that we want to write into the pixel is this one. This here is the value in the frame buffer that is written there right now at the moment. And we just blend between the two. So we take a weight alpha. And alpha tells me how important or the weight of the new fragment. And 1 minus alpha is accordingly the weight, how much the old fragment is considered. Yeah, so if we say the new fragment, for instance, has an alpha of 50%, then the new color is just 50% of the old color plus 50% of the new color. And if the new color has an alpha of 2/3, then 1/3 of the old color plus 2/3 of the new color are taken. Yeah? And if you think about that a little bit, alpha obviously describes how transparent the object is. Yeah, if the object has a small alpha, yeah, then mostly the old color survives, so the object is very transparent, it only contributes little. And if alpha is large, yeah, then the new color is more important than the old color. That means less transparent. And so alpha is obviously not transparency. It is 1 minus transparency. Yeah? The larger alpha, the less transparent it is. And this opposite of transparency is called opacity. That's a word. I think if you look it up in a dictionary, opacität in German does exist, but nobody knows that. has anybody heard about opacität before? Oh, wow. Okay. But in context with computer graphics or with?
With watercolors.
With watercolors. Okay, yeah. That watercolors is a perfect example also for here. Yeah, opacity then means how much water do you use and how much of the watercolor. Okay, good. So alpha, yeah, if we do that blending, then alpha simply is, or simply, then alpha is opacity. Okay, yeah. So how can we use that? And yeah, there was a quite clever idea to handle alpha. And that is, I mean, there's the observation that RGB, the three colors that we use, I mean, the three comes from the human eye, but three is a very strange number for computer scientists. Yeah, so you say four would be much nicer. Yeah, so we can add a fourth channel to our colors, and this color we call opacity. Yeah, and we use this fourth channel to store opacity. That makes perfect sense. I mean, it's funny because we also live in a three-dimensional world. We cannot control that number three, but here this issue that we have, that four is a nicer number, is exploited by using homogeneous coordinates. Yeah, and for RGB, which is also three, we take the fourth channel now for alpha. Okay, so that means whenever you specify colors, and that's also in OpenGL, you can define a fourth color component, and this is typically interpreted as alpha, as opacity. And now the result is the following. So let's say you have this color here, a very transparent red, and on top of this you draw an opaque green. Then this color here, if this is combined, yeah, then typically the alpha of the new color is selected. And in that case, this simply means the pixel gets green. Yeah, the opaque green completely draws over, yeah, and it covers completely the background. So alpha equals 1 is what we had up to now. Yeah, that was, we just override the pixel with a new color. If we make it the other way around, so we first draw green, yeah, and then a very transparent red on top of this. Now here, alpha is 0.1, so what happens is that we get 90% of the old color plus 10% of the new one. So it is still mostly green with some little red in it. Yeah, and that's right. We rendered very transparent red on top of green. Yeah, so it's just a green that gets a little bit more yellowish. Okay, good. So that's quite simple. Yeah, and in fact, it's supported by, yeah, again, OpenGL, what we typically use. So that works nicely, but there are two problems now. And as I already explained in that example, yeah, now the color, the resulting final color of a pixel, again, depends on the drawing order. If I first draw the transparent red and then the green, yeah, I get green. And if I first draw green and then red, I also get green, but at least there's some red in it. Yeah, whereas here there's no red at all. So obviously now again the order of the objects is important. Yeah, and yeah, so alpha blending is not commutative. Difficult word. Yeah, so if we first draw, or if we draw 50% red over 50% green over 100% white, we get something different than if we draw 50% green over 50% red over 100% white. Yeah? So you see here, these colors are quite different. Okay, so what does that mean? That means, again, now we have to take care of the order, and we ideally would somehow combine that with our set buffer. Yeah, for handling occlusion, yeah, we had the same problem. We said with the painter's algorithm, we have to render the objects back to front, then we get the right solution. And we saw, okay, with the set buffer, we can do that easier. And here we see now for alpha blending, we also have to take care that we render the objects in the right order, but in fact, we cannot combine that with a depth buffer. Why so? Yeah, it's very simple. So let's assume sphere one is, or sphere one and sphere two are two transparent spheres, two transparent objects. Yeah? And now we render them with a depth buffer. And one is in front of two. Yeah? So ideally, we first render sphere two. This gives us the color of sphere two. And then on top of it, we render sphere one. Yeah? So they are blended correctly. That's fine. Yeah? That's exactly that what we had here. Yeah? Okay, but now if we first render sphere one, what will happen is that sphere one is written to the depth buffer. Yeah? And if we now render sphere two, this part here will not be rendered at all because it doesn't pass the set buffer test. Yeah? The set buffer assumes that objects are completely opaque. That means whenever an object is drawn, everything behind that object is thrown away. But in that case, it should not be thrown away because one is transparent. Yeah? You can see the background through it. So object two, even if it's hidden, it contributes to the final image. So it's not compatible with a set buffer. Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Good. So now we are back at square one. So what should we do? And so in fact, there are two engineering solutions, I would say. The first one is that we observe, first of all, that typically in a scene, most objects are opaque. Yeah? It's only a minority of objects that are transparent. I mean, of course, you can always construct scenes where this is not the case, but typically this is the case. So most of the times, a solution is sufficient that you say, OK, I first render opaque objects, yeah, with a set buffer. That's fine. There I make no mistakes. Yeah? And then in the second pass, I render the transparent objects, yeah, on top of that. For this step, I disable the set buffer, yeah, because otherwise we have again this problem here. And instead, in that phase, I sort the objects back to front. Yeah? Since these transparent objects are just a minority in many viewer, I can sort them back to front, these few objects, and then render them back to front. And then the blending works correct, yeah, delivers the right result. And yeah, that's a very reasonable compromise. If the number of transparent objects is small, the sorting doesn't really hurt. It's not too bad, and we get a correct solution. Not very wasteful, in fact, this is what we have here as approach B. Of course, approach A would also be possible. That would mean not to take the set buffer at all, and again, to render all objects back to front. But then we have to sort more objects. And in practice, another approach is quite often used, and it exploits the fact that here, the order obviously is important for the result, but I think none of you would be able to say for this example which object is in front, right? It could be either way. After some thinking, I would say that here the green one is in front and here the red one, but I mean, I wouldn't really notice if it would be the other way around. So another solution that is often used in practice is just first render the opaque objects, then turn off the set buffer. That means do not update the set buffer anymore. And then render transparent objects without sorting. And if two transparent objects overlap, the result is wrong, but nobody cares. OK, good. So that's a quite simple solution, but practical solution. And just to mention it at this point, this alpha blending is an operation that is really very useful for many different applications. And another application where it is very, very important is volume rendering. So the idea of volume rendering is that you do not have, or the scene that we want to render is not a surface described as a polygonal mesh, but instead it's a kind of foggy little object. Yeah, you have a cube, and for points in that cube, you know how dense this point is. Yeah, you have a volumetric nature of the object. What you could describe nicely with that is a cloud. Yeah, you will never be able, or I mean, it doesn't make sense to describe the surface of a cloud. Yeah, it's something fuzzy. It doesn't really have a surface. It's something that has densities inside. And yeah, such objects are very common because you can generate such volumetric objects using CT scanners, MRI scanners, whatever. Yeah, medical applications typically use that representation. And of course, you also want to be able to render these. And this is typically done using alpha blending. So what happens here is that just through this volume data set, slices are laid. And for each of these, so ideally many slices, and for each point on the slice, then an opacity value is computed. That's exactly this alpha. And then these slides are rendered from back to front. And when rendering these and blending them together, you can see here the visual reconstruction of that underlying volumetric data set. Yeah? OK, just as a little side remark. And on Thursday, I will finish that chapter and will describe two nice ways how we can generate transparency much nicer as before. And maybe I will show you the final result, because it's a really nice image. So that's very difficult transparency. Okay, and it's even moving. So that's an object with lots of transparency, sometimes up to 100 transparent objects within a pixel. And next time I will explain how this can be rendered with correct transparency, sorting, and stuff like that. And that will be on Thursday, 12:30. And on Thursday, we will have 45 minutes. It's next Thursday that we make longer. Thank you. See you then.